My name is Representative Johnny Ellison. I'd like to welcome all of you here this morning to this meeting of the House Health, Education, and Social Services Committee. And I would note for the record that today is September 23rd, 1988, and the time is approximately 8:40 a.m. And we're online today in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. We're joined by Co-Chairman Nilo Kopanen at the Fairbanks site, Representative Bill Hudson of the HES Committee in Juneau, and Representative Virginia Collins is with us here in Anchorage, and we appreciate her participation. Other committee members will be joining us later today and during the continuation of the hearing tomorrow. Once again, if you have not signed in, agency people or members of the public, please make sure you do that. We'd like to have a full record of participation here today. We do have copies of the agenda there at the back of the room, and we plan to stick to that just as much as possible. I will try and remain flexible throughout, but we would like to get through this material because this first hearing is designed to build a public record to inform legislators, especially committee members, of the system that's currently in place, and to build toward our legislative discussions later this interim and next session. We appreciate those of you who are with us today who care about children, families, and the professionals involved in foster care here in the state of Alaska. And our committee, I guess just in very short, is interested in how we can learning more about the system and what your jobs are, all of you that make up the treatment team dealing with children in state custody, and find out the ways that we can productively work with you through the legislative process to enhance the strengths of the current system, to address any of the weaknesses in the current system, and try and make this a very positive approach to the needs of children in state custody, those especially in foster care. So with that said, I will see if there are any comments, opening comments from other members of the committee, and first go to Representative Kopanen. If you'd like to say anything, let's see if committee members have any comments, and then we would move on to Yvonne Chase for a briefing from the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Family and Youth Services.
Yes, this is Representative Kopanen in Fairbanks. I'd like to thank the DFYS for the material they've provided, the very exhaustive answers they've given to the questions, and to the diagram showing the way in which cases are handled. I think the flow chart is very informative, and I look forward to a good set of hearings. As I remarked slightly before the meeting began, one of the questions raised by the information is whether we might not, as a committee, entertain some examination by other professionals to look at the data as to the families and types of communities to see whether there may be some sort of preventative services, perhaps wholly outside of the scope of DFYS, something dealing with the social structure in different communities that could be done. Obviously, there's a great deal of social and familial dislocation, and the task of the DFYS, in this case, in foster care, is, of course, somewhat the same as we have in the emergency medical services, scoop and run, and provide the service after the dislocation has occurred. Prevention is sometimes much to be desired, and that may be wholly outside of the scope of the department. I have no ideas of how or what might be done, but it might be worth examining.
Representative Kopanen, thank you very much. Are there any other comments from committee members?
Johnny, this is
Representative Hudson. Are you there with us at the have you joined us at the Juneau site?
Johnny, this is Bill Hudson. I just wanted to can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please go ahead.
Okay, fine. Well, number one, just to say good morning to all of you. Haven't seen you for a while. Nice to hear your voices and get back in the saddle with you here again. I think this is a very important subject. I watched that national network presentation on foster care across the nation, and I don't think we have near the complexities of problems that they have in the inner cities and things of this nature. But I think this is an area that we didn't give the kind of attention that probably we're going to give it this next session. So I look forward to the next day or so here and just want to say hello to all of you.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. It's great to have you with us. I'd note that for those present, that this subject of foster care and the Division of Family and Youth Services, when our committee was polled, when the HES committee was polled at the end of the session, this was the area of greatest interest as an interim project. And like I said, other committee members have been paying attention to this subject and will be joining us later. Once again, Jay Livey and department and division staff have done an excellent job, and I believe those of you at other sites around the state have most of the, or all of the materials that we do here, especially a flow chart of how the procedure works. We have a visual aid here on the wall at the Anchorage LIO, but I believe you all have a hard copy of that material. I just note that we do have a number of books and studies and laws from other states relating to foster care, and those materials can be shared with people around the state. Committee staff can fulfill any requests of that nature. If there's nothing further, let's go ahead and stay on time here, and our first segment is devoted to an overview of the foster care system, and I'll turn things over to Yvonne Chase.
Hello, Representative Ellis and Representative Coburn. This is Lisa McLaren. I've just arrived in Juneau.
Okay, good to hear you're there. Representative Hudson had mentioned the television thing. I've taped that. If I can keep my family members from taping some cartoon over it, I'll have it available on the VHS copy of that television show available for the committee.
Thank you very much, Lisa. It's good to have you with us. Let's go ahead with the director of the division.
Thank you. This is Yvonne Chase, Director of Family and Youth Services. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Ellis, for the opportunity for both the Department of Health and Social Services and Law to present. This morning, what we would like to do is to do a joint briefing with the Department of Law. I would like to introduce the people who will be speaking in the first segment. First, I'd like to introduce Pat Kennedy, who's an assistant AG in the Anchorage office in the Human Services section. And also, I would like to introduce Steve Wilson, who is a social services program coordinator with the Division of Family and Youth Services and is recently appointed to the position for the training coordinator statewide for the division. Pleased to have both of them here with me this morning. I would like to have a start by walking everyone through the system, which, as you can see by the chart that we have on the wall here in Anchorage and ones that we have sent to the other sites, can be a fairly complex system. I'm going to ask that Steve and Pat do this together, and then I'd like to make some comments about the less and more perfect world and how it works with the system. Representative Ellis, they would like to stand up by the chart. I don't know if that's going to be able to carry the microphone.
No, it's possible for them to come over and just hold the microphone in their hand as they discuss the system.
Hello, this is Steve Wilson. Thank you. Pat and I are going to sort of share this, and we're going to switch back and forth from where social services is involved and then where the legal system gets involved. It's nice to be able to walk you through this, as most of our social workers seem to be running through this flowchart. In the beginning, we get, I'm going to refer to the flow chart that is on the wall here and also hopefully in front of you at other offices. We begin by receiving a report that may come from any concerned citizen, teacher, medical provider, etc. And those reports are usually suspicions of some type of abuse or neglect going on. And at that point, the division, usually their intake investigative workers, get involved and do an investigation. Sometimes at this point, insufficient information to investigate, the case just stops right there. We may get part of a name of a child. We may get a name of a child with no address. We may get very scant information, which does not give us enough to locate this person or to do an investigation. And at that point, that would stop, but any information we had on that case would be kept in in Fairbanks what we call an accordion file, so that if we get more information on that, we can get back involved if necessary. If we're able to, if we have enough information to locate the family and talk with them, then the investigation does begin, and the social worker starts gathering as much information as possible, and we'll start providing any support and interventions right at that point, if possible, if the families are willing to follow through with some of those. If the report is not confirmed, then the case stops right there. At that point where the case stops, it is often that the social worker is also giving some other referral sources to that family if there are some problems that they've noted but do not necessitate the division's input. We do make some referrals so that, as Representative Kopanen was suggesting, that they can start some of the preventative services and not end up in the Child Protective Services system. If the report is confirmed, then everything on the rest of the flows chart starts to kick in. Once that report's confirmed, the social worker, usually in conjunction with peers or supervisor, makes a decision on whether or not they feel that custody may be necessary. If custody is not necessary, then, and the child is considered not in imminent danger, then the social worker will offer services to that family. And cases opened, the social worker will start developing a relationship with the family. They'll start trying to locate resources in the community that will help that family so that it does not become an imminent danger case. And then we then become sort of a support and advocate for that family and following through with counseling or parenting classes or some type of an educational program, providing lots of referrals and information, and become just someone that's available for that family to call with questions. A lot of parents today are real concerned about the behavior of teenagers and get very frustrated, as do we all. And this is a point where the social worker is able to give some good information and help out to get that family working together to avoid future problems. Before I go up to report confirmed, let me follow over on the flow chart here to family services unsuccessful. There are times when we get involved with families that there's not imminent danger obvious right off the bat, and we start providing some services and follow through this family trying to support and advocate for them. In cases where the family does not follow through, often there becomes an issue of imminent danger for that child, and at that point we move into the legal process that Pat will talk about in just a minute. If services are successful, then we try to close that case. It's my feeling that we try to provide those services and close that case as soon as possible. We give the information that we need to give, and then it's almost like a vote of confidence to families that we know that you can follow through. When that case stops, hopefully that family has developed with their social worker some type of a follow-up plan at the stop stage. Once the case is closed, the only contact we'll have with that family is if they should call in for further information or assistance, and hopefully they've developed a follow-up plan that they're working on to prevent coming back into our system. If, going back to the investigation, if the report is confirmed and there is imminent danger, then we need to start going through the legal process so that we can get some legal custody and have the ability to work with this family. And Pat's going to talk now about what happens at that point.
I'm Pat Kennedy, and I'm with the Department of Law for those of you in the outlying areas. Starting on the point where we file a petition, we file petitions in basically two cases where there's imminent danger and we wish to take emergency physical custody, but also we file non-emergency petitions where there is resistance on the part of the family, but the children aren't in immediate physical or emotional danger or in danger of sexual abuse. So the next line is we either are requesting temporary custody or we have taken temporary custody. Often temporary custody is taken by police departments, by the way, not necessarily just social workers. If temporary custody is not sought, then we file a non-emergency petition and we go right through to the adjudication hearing, which is the bottom line. And an adjudication hearing is basically a trial on the issues that we have alleged. I'd say about 80 to 90% of our adjudications stipulate by the time we get to them. That is, everybody agrees there's a problem. But there are contested adjudications, in which case they become mini trials in front of a judge. if we have sought temporary custody, then we must, within 48 hours of the time we take custody of the child, be in front of the court explaining to them why we have physically taken the child out of the home. If the cause for custody is not established, that is, the court finds there is no immediate danger and the child could have been left in the household, the court will do one of two things: either dismiss the case because there is no case at all and return the children, in which case the case disappears, or keep the case continuing, give legal custody to the state, but return the children to the parents pending adjudication and services. If the cause is established, then a placement is selected, and Steve will be covering that in a minute. I do want to point out that from the time we file a petition, there is a series of outside agencies which come in as sort of a supervisory role. The main one is the court system. But in most normal cases where there's an allegation of abuse or neglect, there is a guardian ad litem appointed for the child. The parents also have a right to have public attorneys appointed for them if they are indigent. And so that all, these three sections operate as sort of review and try to keep us on track with what we're doing. Also in Anchorage and hopefully soon in Ketchikan, we have a foster care review board plan that is operating under the Office of Public Advocacy. And within 2 weeks, there is a citizen panel which reviews the emergency custody and foster care placement of any child in every third case. That is, they don't have enough time to do all of them. So they just randomly select, as they come into the system, every third case to do a full review of whether or not reasonable efforts were made to prevent the removal of the child from the home. And they make that report to all the people in the system plus the court system. And there's a further review at 60 days. If the child is still in placement from the same panel. So, Steve?
Just to follow up for a second on the assistance that we get in monitoring cases and providing some quality control. Once we get involved in a case and we start making referrals to doctors, psychologists, mental health providers, then they become part of our team, and they're also providing a lot of input to us in some direction and helping us work with this family. Also, just to follow up on reviews, in the last few years, we've started a process where every 6 months that a child is out of the home in a placement, we have a review committee that meets, and that review committee usually involves a supervisor from the agency, perhaps a social worker that's not involved in the case. In Fairbanks, we have a community member that sits on that, and we invite parents, foster parents, and some children. And at that point, we also get a lot of input, hopefully for some more quality control, and hopefully to develop an attitude of working together. I want to mention that in this real early stage where we may find imminent danger and assume emergency custody of a child, it's extremely frustrating for the social worker and the foster parents and probably the child also. We have very little information often at that point about the family, about the children. The only information we may be sure of is that the child is in imminent danger. I know that's frustrating for foster parents because they get children that they don't know a lot of background about, and it's just as frustrating for social workers, and hopefully together the social worker and the foster parent can start learning more about this child, possibly not so much about the family history, but how the child copes and reacts to different things going on in their life. At this part, after the cause established, placement selected, I'm looking at the box, foster care, relative, and residential care. It is our priority to try to locate a relative to help with this child and help with this case and possibly assume some of the custodial responsibilities. And in the division, we call that a relative search, and we quite extensively try to find out, especially what relatives may be in Alaska and any relatives that may be anywhere in the country or the world. Once we find relatives that may be interested, if they're out of the state of Alaska, then it takes us a little time to get that child to those relatives because we go through an interstate compact for the placement of children process in which we ask another state to visit, another state child protective agency to visit with this family and give us some type of report if they think this family has the same problems as the family we're dealing with, or if they can be supportive and helpful to this child. Once that process is accomplished, then we can often place these children with relatives. In a way, I think that's the best way to go, to look for relative placements. It can sometimes cause some problems if the parents remain in Alaska and want to work at reunification, then we may want to work out an agreement with them so that we can possibly bypass that out-of-state relative placement and keep the child in state so we can be beginning the family counseling. It's my sense that the more contact clinically we have with families and their children together, the sooner we can get them back together and back out of placement and out of our system. If there are no relatives able to care for this child, then we do look for a foster care placement. It is our, in the best of all possible worlds, that child may possibly be in an emergency custody foster home. And as we start finding placements, we try to arrange some type of visitation. We locate a foster home that we think will meet the needs of this child, and then that child has lunch with these foster parents, might go for dinner. In some cases, if we have the privilege of time, might even spend a weekend with them. They get to know each other. Foster child can explain what they expect. Foster parents talk about rules and regulations in their home. They make the decision, and then we're able to make the placement. And I think that those placements are a lot more positive because everybody's had a chance to get more information about each other. But more often, the case is that a foster care placement is needed very quickly. And we try to find foster parents that are have openings in their home and place that child. And at that point, the social worker needs to be doing a lot of contact, telephone contact, personal visits with the foster home to help them understand some of the particular needs that the child may have. Some of the children that we get involved with have been severely damaged, and loud voices to them, if they're yelled at in some type of discipline, can bring back some of those fears of getting hit. They can also be very frustrating children sometimes and can be very normal in doing a lot of the things that a lot of our own kids do. And so it's at that point that the social worker can be very helpful to the foster parents by supporting them, suggesting some interventions, suggesting some behavioral management programs, such as a candy program or token economy or anything to help that child to try to follow the rules and then get certain rewards from it. In some situations, the children that we become involved with are damaged to a point that they cannot succeed in a foster care placement. And usually we don't find this out until they've been in foster care placement for some point in time. And I think that usually they've been in more than one foster care placement because we may try another placement to see if that would work with them. If nothing's working, then we start looking around for some residential care where the child can live in a various-sized group home, and they are then getting 24-hour monitoring, lots of group meetings with other children that are in their same situation, lots of contact with counselors, lots of contact with the clinical staff of that particular residential center. And the social worker still remains very involved in that, helping to develop the treatment plan with the residential facility and also helping to bring the residential facility staff into the group of partners that begins working with the natural family to get this child back home as soon as possible. At while all this may be going on during the temporary custody stage that Pat mentioned, and that could be anywhere from 1 day to 90 days and sometimes even more, at the end of that temporary custody stage, we're ready to go into court to go through with the final adjudication and put on evidence, and Pat's going to talk about some of the reports that we're preparing during that time.
Two issues we should point out, by the way. At any time during this temporary custody period, the social worker, in conjunction with the guardian ad litem, can agree that the children should be returned home and may even agree that the case can be dismissed. So it's not like all of these cases get through this process. A whole lot of them drop out in the process. Also, one other problem, which we did want to mention, is the confidentiality statute, which is 4710090. Which is an almost absolute prohibition against sharing information with anybody. That is not exactly what's going on, because otherwise we couldn't give foster parents any information or arrange for any treatment or deal with any other resources in the system. So we do give information to people who have a need to know, but the statute itself is a problem. The next step, if we get that far and the issues are contested, is an adjudication hearing. That is where we go to court, have a full trial, if it's contested, and prove our case in court. And what we need to prove is the facts we've originally alleged in the petition. That is, not where we are now, but where we were when we originally took custody, which confuses people a lot. If the allegation is not proven at the end of trial, then the case is dismissed by the judge. If the allegation is proven, then we set it on for what we call a disposition, which is where the caseworker and the guardian ad litem, if there is one, and possibly the parents, prepare the plan, which is going to be the treatment plan to get the whole thing out of the system. I would note, since we're talking about foster care in general, that the same track applies to criminal cases where you're talking about delinquents. It's just that the players and the names change. But the kids get into the system the same way. If there's a request for custody at the time that they are accused of committing a crime, they do go into the same system, although it's a separate foster care and supervisory system. And we do eventually have to take them to trial on the delinquencies if they don't agree that they've committed the crime. At the time we set the predisposition reports, those are reports that are prepared by the caseworker and the guardian ad litem for the court 10 days in advance to indicate what their plan is for the case and what they're going to be requesting from the court. And disposition hearings are normally set within about 60 days of the time you do the adjudication. We have had adjudication trials that are very time-consuming. I had one that went 5 weeks. So they are sometimes very serious trials, and they sometimes take a lot of time and energy.
In the vast majority of our cases where we are going for custody and we've gotten temporary custody and going for adjudication, we do ask that a guardian ad litem be appointed. The role of the guardian ad litem is very important because they almost become a neutral party in this. Their job is not necessarily to be an attorney for any particular party, but to look out for the best interest of this child. And they make recommendations to the parents, to the child, to the division, and also to the court. And they become a very important team player. After the predisposition report and disposition hearing, we can then start really getting involved in working with the child and looking for placement. By this time, hopefully, we've gathered quite a bit of information, and that's what the predisposition report is all about. We've started to become acquainted with the players or family members and are having an idea of what kind of services are needed to get this family back together as soon as possible. And in some of those cases, are able to determine that this is a child that we're going to need to make some very long-range planning on. Once if the allegations are proven and the adjudication has been, the child has been adjudicated, we move right into our treatment phase. The cases that Pat mentioned that don't go through this, that stipulate very early on where all parties agree there's a problem, I think we're able to start working with this family a lot sooner. When there's an adjudication that is 60 days down the road, people are understandably a little bit shy of talking to their social worker and start talking about a lot of things going on in the family. It's very frustrating for everybody involved in that point. It's frustrating for the parents because they may not have started services yet. It's frustrating for the foster parent because we can't tell them how long or short this placement's going to be. It's also can be, well, that's enough on that. At that point, there's a number of types of treatment that might kick in, and the adjudication is a very helpful hammer, if I may use the word, to motivate people through treatment. My own personal philosophy and my background is in family violence is that parents do not want to hurt their children, and in cases where parents do want to hurt their children, it makes it a pretty simple, clear-cut way of dealing with it. In the cases where parents do not want to, but their anger is being expressed in a way that hurts the children, we need that court sanction, which is, to me, sort of a representation of society's sanction against violence against children. That becomes very important to the parents. I think at that point they can say, okay, I have a problem, the court's decided I have a problem, I'm going to stop fighting about whether or not I have a problem, and then we can start working and get involved in treatment right away. In Fairbanks, we've had an experimental treatment unit for the last couple of years that I hope will continue, where we try to get involved with the family as soon as they come in at this intake process and work with that family for 90 days. It's our goal that if a child comes in foster care into this unit, that we get that child back home within the first 30 days so that we can work with the family with the child in the home. And it's my feeling that the sooner treatment starts, the faster we can get that child home and the better their working relationship is between the division and the family. But like I said, in some cases we need that court sanction to mandate treatment for parents. And there's a very high motivator for them because they need to follow through with this in order to get their children back. Most normally the kinds of treatment that we're looking for are some type of parenting skills group to help parents deal with discipline in a more assertive, non-aggressive way. We also may possibly want the parents to get some individual or couples counseling so that they can start resolving some of their personal and interpersonal problems so that this unregulated anger is not expressed against the children. In the treatment program in Fairbanks, we offer a lot of parenting information and a lot of anger regulation information. During disposition, the child has probably been in placement, and at that point we may have completed the interstate compact process to locate with a relative outside. If there was a relative in the community, then the child may well be placed with that relative. At that point, we also probably have a pretty good sense of whether or not this child is going to need some residential care. If all of the things I've mentioned are successful, I go down here to the treatment successful part, case stop. I want to just mention that all these red stops, at least in Anchorage they're red on the chart, are not as final as they may look, because we're always having that family leave the agency with some type of a follow-up plan, some things that they can continue doing so that the problem doesn't reemerge. And a lot of these families that do work successfully through their problems to get their children back often are contacting their social workers, once a week, once a month, a couple of times a year, just to tell them how we're doing, or this same old problem is coming up, could you give us some information? Without actually opening a case, we can provide some referral sources and some help over the telephone. If treatment is unsuccessful and the stage of which that is decided is usually quite into the case, and we may have been involved with this family now for 6 months, a year, or even 2 or 3 years, trying to provide as many appropriate remedial services as possible to get rid of those elements or ingredients that caused the family violence in the first place. It's all social workers hope that they can be successful and return these children. But there are those instances, as we're all aware of, where treatment is unsuccessful and the child remains in imminent danger if they would be returned home. And at that point, we may be going back into the legal system and using them to help us resolve the situation. And Pat's going to mention what happens at that stage.
It's required by law that if we decide to terminate parental rights, we have to take a new petition. That is, we need to refile in court, go through all the processes that we've been through in treatment, and explain to the court why we need to cut off the parental rights of these parents to these children, because the problem is likely to continue, is the way the statute reads. If we file a petition for termination, we normally have a trial. In my experience, a great majority of these are substance abusive parents who are not willing or unable to get treatment so that they can become functional again with their children. Once we get into the trial, there is a possibility that the petition for termination is not granted. It is a disposition petition. That is, we're asking for a specific disposition by the court. There is a line here which says case dismissed. That's somewhat misleading. The case is not dismissed. The petition to terminate is dismissed, but the Department of Health and Social Services would normally retain custody under the prior disposition. It is possible also that the court will find that there's been a cure, if you will, and send the kids home. I've never had a case like that, although I think there is one or two around the system. If the the petition is not granted, it does not mean that the children necessarily are released back to the parents. It just means that the court is finding that, that it may be that parents can be fixed, if you will, and it therefore mandates the department to go ahead and continue with services. If the petition is granted, the child is placed with the department for adoption and for placement in a suitable placement. We do some relinquishments at this stage, that is, the parents voluntarily sign over the children for adoption, and some of those relinquishments are to specific people, that is, relatives or other people that the parents feel will take care of the children, or in some cases, they do it on an open basis. That is, we agree that they can have visitations with their children. This is particularly true with older children, even if the children are adopted by someone else.
At this stage, I think some of the feelings or emotions the social workers going through are real mixed. On one level, they're real pleased. I've worked with this family. They did not respond to treatment. I've got this child terminated. Isn't that wonderful? Now I can find a long-time healthy placement for this child so this child can grow up and be able to reach their abilities. But it's also, there's the other part of that where the social worker is feeling pretty badly about having to go through that termination process. It's at the way end of our list here because it's the very last thing that we want to consider. We want to get these children back home. It's my feeling that children are better off in their own homes. So it's a real double-edged sword there. You're sad that it didn't work and there's termination, but you're also happy that you can start to place this child. At that point, we start searching for permanent placement for the child, where the child can grow up to age of majority. There are times when the child has now been in custody for quite a while, maybe 3, 5, even 6 years, and they may have such a strong bond with the foster parents that those foster parents may be interested in adopting that child, and sometimes that's possible. I think it may be more likely that the foster parents are providing foster care and are not willing to adopt, and in those cases, we then start looking for permanent placement. When I talked about in the best of all possible worlds, earlier on, we get this child to do a lot of visitation with their possible foster parents before we make that placement. This goes on at an even more intense level with when we're into the permanent placement adoption stage. And there's a lot more visitation, a lot more contact before we even move the child into that family. And then once the child does move into the family, before the adoption is finalized, we monitor that case for at least 6 months to make sure that things are going okay. And at that point, we're able to close our case. Like I say, there's that double-edged, but we can close our case successfully. And there's also the other tract here where treatment is successful and none of this has to happen. This, when I look at this flow chart, it's a little overwhelming because there's all these different things going on at the same time. And I just want to mention that for the foster parent involved in this and the social worker, if there was a flow chart that we could design that could accurately describe or show what they're doing during all of this other stuff, then it would definitely make us dizzy. There are just hundreds and hundreds of activities that are going on during this whole case, and there are so many different things that people are dealing with that it would be very hard to be able to work these cases successfully without this team effort that we've sort of brought in through the system. At this point, I'd like to ask if there's any questions from anybody, for either Pat or I or Yvonne.
Do committee members have questions, or Representative Collins?
None here.
Okay. If not, if you think of some, just speak up. I have several to pose to both Pat and Steve. Pat, you mentioned about the confidentiality statute being a problem. What kind of liability, what kind of exposure is there for people currently involved in the system with the statute that we now have in place?
Well, the main liability is a misdemeanor statute. So you sent to jail. I guess that's the big problem. I assume that if someone wanted to sue you because you gave some information, say, to a foster parent or a treatment agency, and they were in some way damaged by that, that they could do that.
Has that happened to date?
We have one case, according to Yvonne. She knows better than I do about whether or not they've sued. She may be able to answer that.
it's also, if I could comment, it's extremely frustrating for the foster parent and the social worker. We're all in this together, working for this child, and there's information that the social worker can't give the foster parent. The foster parent then gets very frustrated and even somewhat angry because they're not getting the information that they may need to work successfully with the child. That starts to make a little division between them, which then takes a lot of extra energy for both parties to put back together. It's so the confidentiality is an issue that social workers and foster parents are always struggling with. It would be nice if we could bring in everybody as team members and give people exactly the information they needed to be able to work with these children and families. It's just extremely frustrating. You're never, as a person who was a caseworker, you never know when you've crossed that line. Even though it may be in the best interest of the child, you may still be on the wrong side of what the statute is on confidentiality.
Has there ever been an internal working group or even an individual who's sat down to make recommendations about reasonable changes in the statute? I mean, have you ever sat around, you know, around cups of coffee and said, you know, if we could, if we were a king for a day, this is how we would change the statute?
Yes, we talk about it all the time. And, in fact, there is a draft that I prepared just basically on a need-to-know issue, that is to change the statute to set out to know and set out guidelines for who would need to know information under what conditions. It would include provisions like a need to provide for treatment, a need to provide for placement, et cetera. And those are the...
If you all are happy to or comfortable sharing with us specifics, I think we'd like to entertain that information later on at the next meeting or whenever it's convenient.
Professor Nellis, I'd like to mention that when I was with the school district as director of research and planning, it was very frustrating because we wouldn't even be told which schools the children at risk were attending or any number of them, therefore making it impossible for us to plan any sort of supportive services in the schools on a prior basis. And I could never see how there was a violation of confidentiality when all we were looking for was aggregated information. And I think there is a very real need, if we're going to do anything meaningful, to work a bit with this confidentiality statute.
Go ahead, Steve.
It's my sense, and I can only speak from a perspective of Fairbanks because that's where I've been working, that this is a problem. I know that because my wife is a teacher and is often trying to get information out of me about particular children that she sees are disturbed and wondering if they are in custody. I'm not sure if it's as much of an issue as it may have been back then, because I think we've crossed over the line quite a bit and entering into a lot of liability. We're having staffings where we are inviting teachers, where we're inviting school nurses, where we have to consult with them so that they know that this is a child that has been removed from the home, but we're keeping him in the same school, but now they're in a foster home, et cetera, et cetera. And it's real scary how often we have to cross that line and include these people who are necessary to some of our staffings and input. The teachers and school nurses and school counselors have an incredible amount of information about this child, how they're reacting to certain things. We see a lot of behavior in school that is indicative of what's going on in the family home or in the foster home. And so I think that we do include them. And I'm never quite sure how far over the line we are when we do include them. I'd also just like to make one other comment that it would be nice in the best of all possible worlds if the foster parents could receive a lot more information than they do so that they could actually start doing some outreach and work with the natural family, so that, there are some foster parents that are willing to have visits take place in the home and other types of contacts. Also, after a child's been in custody for a while, it's nice if the foster parents are connected with the parents when that child goes home to be able to let them know how they've dealt successfully with certain problems in the past year. And it's just one of those... For me, it's one of those blocks that makes social work sort of exciting. It's frustrating, but you have to be pretty quick to figure out how to get around some of those to get the best things happening in a case for children.
Okay, well, there's one area we've identified for further work, and we will be hearing from the foster parents extensively later on in the program, and that's where I've first heard of this concern. And then just the question of exposure of the professionals here is troubling. So if the laws are out of date or not specifically dealing with the practice and the best interests of children, we need to delve into that. It was mentioned that every third case is reviewed. Pat, I think you made that comment by the citizens panel. I'm wondering if you characterize just how in-depth those reviews are.
Well, I think Pam Montgomery will probably be speaking to you a little later on today about that whole program, so she probably could do it. But roughly, it's a three-person panel in Anchorage that takes or what could have been done or what might have been done if we had more money or services to do it.
And, or what they've done well.
Or whether they've done well or whether they haven't done well. And we've only had the first panel, I think, met September 15th, so we're just getting started on the process.
Excuse me, Representative Ellis. This is Lisa McLaren in Juneau. I wanted to let you know that Representative Ulmer has joined us.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Ulmer, we're glad to have you with us. Third question. Do either of you care to comment on the availability of treatment and follow-up services for families who do have coverage or access to third-party payments versus those who are in less fortunate circumstances?
Well, I can comment from having worked cases. You walk into a case plan, and in general, we'll all sit there and go, well, here's what we need to have happen. And if they don't have services, they're on a six-week waiting list to even get into crisis counseling in Anchorage. If they do have money, they can walk into any provider, and that's the difference. It's the old theory that, you know, you get what you pay for, I think, and there's not enough money in the treatment end. And what happens is everybody buys a part of the system. That is, if you buy more social workers because you have more crises, but once you get to the other side of the crisis, you've got no place to put these people to get them out of crisis. And so you can cut services in the private sector. By doing that, you end up with a lot of very poor people who are in a lot of crisis, not getting anywhere for months and months, having their kids just sort of mold in foster care while we try to get them service.
Steve, I'd also like to comment. I think this is really relates to the issue that Representative Kopanen brought up about. Because similarly, if we had the kind of prevention and education and treatment services that started popping into my mind when he talked about prevention, we would also be able to work with families after the fact when they do get involved with us. In Fairbanks, it's been a very frustrating year because this spring we lost, I think, between three and five providers in the community. Three of those were clinical psychologists. Two or three of those were master's-level social workers that had been doing a lot of private treatment in the community. It gets real scary as a social worker when you're charged with this very important responsibility of developing and creating a network of resources for a family so they can get their child back, and the resources are either not there or the resources are so understaffed that there is such a long waiting list that the social worker then is much more involved with that family during that six-week waiting period, but they've also got a possibility of anywhere from 75 to 150, 200 people that may be in similar situations that they're working with. What the experimental treatment program that I think is not experimental anymore, but is pretty much there in Fairbanks, was sort of a response to that. We wanted to start treatment immediately because we felt it would cut down on a lot of the barriers that build up through the case and also start providing those urgent, immediate services right away. It's extremely frustrating for the service community to have cases where you have an idea of what this family needs and you can't get them into them. And I think, is another issue that I hope that the House would look at in stimulating the development of more private services out in the communities.
And finally, on the termination of parental rights, here in Alaska, what are the rules of evidence or the standards on or the basis on which termination can occur? Are there explicit things set in the law or regulation that the decision turns on?
Yes. Well, it gets a little complicated because you've got an Indian Child Welfare Act out there which changes the standard of proof for Indian children, and so you have like three standards of proof depending on what you're talking about. State standard basically says that the children are children in need of aid as a result of parental conduct, and that the parental conduct is likely to continue. There's no definition in the statute about what likely to continue means, and that is supposedly shown by clear and convincing evidence. if you have an Indian child, then you have to show by beyond a reasonable doubt that replacement with the parents is likely to result in serious emotional or physical harm to the child as well. So there are like three different standards operating. I think there is a suggestion coming through from our office this year to change that to include the possibility that there should be more definition about what likely to continue means, and that we should have something which says that the parental bond is broken. That is, that these children are no longer see themselves as the children of this particular parent as a result of the conditions that the parents have created. It's particularly true in long-term substance abuse where the child hasn't seen the parents since it was a baby. And in substance abuse, you can never prove wholly that parents' conduct is likely to continue because they may dry out at a given moment. And so it makes these cases very difficult and drags them on for long periods of time. It's also true in serious physical abuse where the children have become so alienated by the physical abuse that there is no parental bond left. So one of the suggestions is to change that to make it more clear what it is the legislature wants terminating for.
So the trend seems to be toward more explicit language for the termination of parental rights. So in terms of the best interest of the child, I know all this is incredibly subjective, but in your opinion, is the child better served by keeping things, well, the trend is toward making it more definite and explicit. I'm just wrestling with the idea of the language being explicit and more narrow, or if it's better and gives more flexibility to act on behalf of the child when the language is more general. I guess when it's a close call, does current practice favor the child or the parents retaining parental rights?
I can only speak in Anchorage, and in my opinion, in Anchorage, it favors the child, but there's nothing in that statute which says anything about the best interest of the child. It only talks about parental conduct. And I think that's one of the problems with the statute.
That's what I was getting toward. Nevada has recently passed a law that has some explicit language that relates to the fitness of the parent, but also to the clear best interest of the child. And when it is a close case, that the child be favored.
There's nothing like that in our statute. Although my general feeling about courts is that they look at this and say, sort of in their own minds, if I were a child, would I want these parents? And then if the answer is no, they terminate parental rights on whatever grounds you give them. The courts tend to be fairly flexible in their own ways, and they kind of go with the best interest, in my opinion. But that's not exactly the way they look at it. And I think it prohibits social services and other groups from thinking about termination because of the way the statute is written.
Do you have another comment, then we'll see if there are questions around the state?
Just a comment from a perspective as a old caseworker. Once you get involved with the court system, sometimes it becomes very frustrating. It seems like there are so many protections for the parents as there should be in the court system, and sometimes at a casework level, it seems like people may ignore the best interest of the child. Just a generic example. If you've moved for termination and a parent has not had a lot of contact with a child, and perhaps it's a substance-abusing parent who just seems to dry out and pull it together just before the termination hearing, and then the judge says, well, we need to give this person another chance, and so you then have to start all over again with visitation, connecting this child back to the parent, and then if they don't pull through and they, for lack of a better word, blow it again, then you go back into termination, and you may then get it. But I look at the damage then to the child whose hopes have been increased that mom or dad have gotten it together and I'm going to go home, or who are these people I'm having to contact now, and then that all changes again, and it just can be very frustrating. It would be nice if we could diagnose termination cases as early as possible so that when you have a child that is 2 years old, rather than looking for an adoptive placement when this child is 7 or 8, that we'd be able to look for an adoptive placement within a year or two if it seems that that's necessary. I think what that does is it gets the child back into a stable, family that they can bond with, they can be part of that family, and they can start living their life again as most normal children. I think it's a pretty frustrating situation, as frustrating as some of the thin lines between confidentiality.
That looks like another area to do a little work on.
Representative Ellis, it strikes me that this is a point where we may perhaps ask for the testimony of child psychologists and child development experts to set the age parameters at which differing standards may apply.
I agree with that, and I think that there are different standards. It is, in my view, it is much more important to move speedily, recklessly, but speedily, in the case of very young children. That first 3 to 5 years is the most important of their life, and we need to get those children stabilized during that age as quickly as possible. And with older children, sometimes adoption may not be necessary. They may continue, as Pat mentioned earlier, to have contact relationships with their family and maybe have a guardianship or be in a long-term foster care. So it's much different within different age groups, and I think that would be helpful to get some expert testimony on that. And there are people in the country that have been researching the whole idea of adoptions and long-term placements that would be helpful.
Any comments or questions from Juneau?
Yes, Johnny, this is Bill Hudson again. I've been following all of this, and, of course, I've been talking to quite a number of foster parents and et cetera, and
Juneau, we've lost you.
Drug abuse. Is that a kind of an overriding factor in all of these cases?
Representative Hudson, you'll need to repeat your comments or your question. We lost the middle section of your statement.
Yes, my question, Mr. Chairman, is there a correlation between the number of children who are totally separated from their parents, where the parental rights are totally terminated, to dysfunctionalism because of alcohol or drug abuse? Is there a direct correlation? Is that a predominant situation?
This is Steve Wilson. That's a tough question to give an easy answer to. I think that, indeed, we all know that the substance abuse problem can completely aggravate the situation. I think that there's a lot of substance abuse issues going on in quite a lot of the families where we do move for termination. But there are also many, many cases where substance abuse may not be the issue, and it may be some other area of their life that is dysfunctional to the point that they can't provide adequate care and supervision of their children. But I do definitely believe that there is a relationship between the extent of the substance abuse and a parent's ability not only to care for their children, but to care enough for themselves to be able to provide an okay environment for those children.
Well, this is Bill Hutz again. That's exactly what my question is. I think that's one of the critical pieces of information that we should try to pull out in these cases. We had some hearings down here, and a couple of things that seemed to pop out. One is that a lot of the kids appear to be just bounced from, say, one family to the next or from one hand to the next, and they begin to lose their own self-esteem. I guess it's because they begin to question who they're bonded with or what their protective system really is. And I'm wondering if streamlining the system, really analyzing carefully as to where these kids are coming from, is there any common threads among, say, the families they're coming from? Are there any things that we can do to bolster those families or to early identify them so that we don't end up with the child not knowing where they live? I know this is kind of rambling, and I've got a lot of things on my notes down here that I'll be trying to pass on to you, Mr. Chairman, later on. But is anybody really examined in depth this whole thing as to maybe prevention?
I'm not familiar specifically, but some other people in the room may be. I think that there is a lot of research that has been done in different fields, in child protection, in substance abuse, and we basically respond based on all these separate fields. I'm not sure that we've ever had a study where we've identified that. I agree with you, and you brought up another one of those double-edged swords that social workers are always involved with. I agree with you. It is very important that we move these cases speedily, and if this child is not going to go home, then we need to make a permanent placement. But you also said the words analyze completely, and that's where the double-edged sword, because analyze completely takes a fairly long time, because we do need to give parents the opportunity to respond to treatment, and at the same time, sometimes that doesn't go along with the speedy part of it.
Thank you.
If there are no further comments, let's go back to the director for to wrap it up or make any other comments she cares to.
Thank you. This is Yvonne again. I think just in closing, a couple more comments about the chart and the process. As you can see from the chart, there are a number of different decision points. One of the things that the chart does not point out are some of the elements that need to be there to make even all of those decisions, irregardless of which way you turn in those forks of the roads, possible and to the best of everyone's ability. The time factor isn't really represented in the chart. The time that it takes to investigate, the time that it takes for the court work, the time that it takes for working with families in treatment, the time that a provider, whether it's a relative placement, foster care placement, or residential care and working with the child. I just want to mention a couple of things with three different categories, what else is needed to try to facilitate the process. I think that for the clients, and some of these have been mentioned, they need to have they need to have readily available services, and just can't stress that enough. I mean, if family ends up being put on a waiting list, I'm gone again.
You just have to speak directly into it.
Right.
If you move from side to side, tends to lose you.
If a family ends up being put on a waiting list with a private provider and the waiting list is 6 months long, the initiative or incentive for the family to really seek treatment is diminished by every day and month that it goes on. They need to have the kind of accessibility to their social worker or probation officer that meets their individual needs. They need to have information about the law and the consequences of child abuse and neglect. And they need to have a clear understanding of their case plan. Providers, and here I'm just going to refer specifically to foster care, although I think many of these same things apply to other providers, need to be well screened, need to have adequate training, need to have sufficient payment for the kinds of things that they are asked to provide for children. They need also to have sufficient access to the social workers and probation officers who manage the cases of the children who are in their homes. They need to have, we need to have consistency across regions. And the way that we work with providers, I think that if you ask providers whether it's foster parents or child residential care providers, whether or not the same procedures seem to be in effect in different regions, you'll probably get a number of different answers. There needs to be communication in both directions from the provider and from the agency to the provider and to the agency. And we need for providers, I think, to build in the initial case plan appropriate respite care. We've talked a little bit about the, I think Steve mentioned, the severity of the needs and the problems that the children that we now place in foster care exhibit. And I would venture to say that when I started in the field of foster care about 20 years ago, that we were placing children who had much less severe problems. We were also placing the ones who had severe problems, but for the majority of children in foster care, I think the problems were much less. If we built appropriate respite care into the case plan, what we would do is not force providers into the stance that they have to wait until they feel like they can't manage, and so they have to come and ask for respite care. It ought to be something that's provided, as a matter of fact, in the case plan. And with some of the children at the very beginning, I think that we also overload providers. We overload the same home with children that have some.
We're losing you.
Trying to.
For those of you around the state, we're going to switch microphones here in Anchorage for Yvonne and see if that helps. Please let us know if.
If what? Yeah, this is Juno. If what?
I think the last comment I was making was about providers that we overload. And
This is Juno, and we're getting nothing here.
Juno, can you hear me now?
Yes, Johnny, I can hear you loud and clear.
I press R.
Okay, Yvonne, why don't you try your microphone again there? We're switching microphones here in Anchorage, too.
Is this better?
Juno.
Is this better? Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Perfectly good.
All right. Who have severe problems. We are able in foster care right now to license a home for up to 5 children. And while some homes can, I think, deal very effectively with 5 children, depending on the ages of the children and the needs of those specific children, what happens with a number of providers is that we often place children who need some very direct one-to-one work on a continuous basis, and to put 4 more in a fairly rapid rate, I think that that presents a difficulty for the child and definitely for the provider. For the agencies, whether it's this division or whether it's the Department of Law or the Office of Public Advocacy, we also need to have staff available, which means sufficient staffing. It also means having staff that are trained, have current policies and procedures, and have some ability to monitor that process. Thank you.
Yvonne, I... In anticipation of this hearing, I was talking to at least one legislator about this whole subject that we were going to be delving into as a committee, and was talking about DFYS, and the legislator remarked to me, oh, didn't we give them some money in that Gitche thing? You know, with the thought that we had solved DFYS's problems and shortages of resources and that sort of thing, you know, with the Gitche thing, you know, we'd given them some money and some positions. And I informed him that I didn't think that was actually the case. But could you just review for us exactly what did come through the budget under the Governor's Interim Commission on Children and Youth, and what's happening with those positions, and how that's strengthened you or met the need, all of the need there, but what has happened in your budget?
There was funding that came to the division in a number of different areas as a result of the Gitche advocacy. We received money in the preventive services area for $703,000. $603,000 was targeted for parenting training programs in the private sector, which both Pat and Steve have indicated the need to have that those early services available. $100,000 of the preventive services money went specifically to runaway programs here in Anchorage, and I believe went to Alaska Youth and Parent Foundation. We received $500,000 in child residential care, and that went into the existing providers to attempt to enhance some of the services that they were providing and to also help with the problems that they were experiencing as a result of cuts in prior years. We received, in terms of staffing, 11 new positions, PCNs, and 2 positions which were upgraded from part-time to full-time. We also received, as a result of the Gitche funding, underfunding for existing positions, which meant that we were able to hire in all of the PCNs that we presently had on the books. That has been a tremendous help. What What I found, however, when I have looked back at the staffing in any one of the regions, staffing, what that meant was a statewide effort that both the underfunding affected all the regions as well as the new PCNs. What we have never done is to actually meet the caseload needs in any one region. And perhaps what we need to look at is putting new resources into a particular region to really look at the effect of the staffing. If we had adequate staffing, what would it actually do in terms of the resource issue? I think it's real important, though, as Pat said and as Steve indicated when they were going through the charts, that if you put money into state positions to have enough social workers to investigate and enough probation officers to carry their caseloads, and you don't put money into the private sector for treatment, we're still in the same problem area, because we have done a faster job, a more speedily job, as Steve said, in doing some of the front-end work. But if we don't have the treatment resources available, we're still keeping families in the system longer than they need to be, and we're keeping children in the system in a real impermanent kind of situation. The statistics that I provided last year, for example, indicated that to bring our caseloads down to something still well above the national standard, we needed approximately twice the number of social work positions that we actually received. And I realize that it's an expense and that you have to weigh those even within the Department of Health and Social Services with some of the other needs of clients that are there as well.
Where is your budget proposal of the division in the internal budget review process?
At this point, I have, for fiscal year 90, I have made for the division recommendations to the commissioner, and she's considered those recommendations, weighed them against recommendations for funding from other divisions, keeping in mind the fact that the department has a huge amount of the budget going to entitlement programs, and again looked at what appeared to be even minimally feasible. Minimally feasible is, again, below the caseload standards that we have developed as a result of case management project that has taken us the last 3 years in working on. I think that it's real important. The case management project, and I have sent information out on it, is important because in the past I think that all we have been able to do is to count the number of cases that any one worker had and indicate to both the commissioner and the legislature that we needed to reduce these cases by X amount. Well, what exactly does that mean? What we've done with the case management project is to come up with a way of assessing whether or not the case that comes into the division is a high-intensity case, a medium-intensity case, or a low-intensity case. And there are some requirements then of agency personnel based on the intensity of the service that's needed on that case. Obviously, a low-intensity case is going to require less service on the part of the agency, but maybe more service on the part of a treatment provider in the community. A high-intensity case, and our standards are slightly different for the rural areas because we have to keep in mind the air travel. But the high-intensity case requires many more phone contacts, many more face-to-face contacts, and closer proximity to each other as well.
You may want to consider, you know, going forward with what you suggested earlier in your comments about committing resources to a particular region as a sort of demonstration project to actually prove to the legislature that adequate funding and reduction of social workers' caseloads would mean something to children and to the system. Because just the, you know, there are people expecting big results from the 11 or 13, the 11 positions and the two upgrades, that something will change for the positive within the system. If that does not indeed occur, you know, advocating for future budget increases for your division just becomes more difficult for the rest of us. So I know you understand that game. Let's go ahead and amend the agenda and just take a five-minute break, come back at 10 o'clock rather than the 15-minute break we had planned, and we'll get on with the next segment. And I'd like to thank Steve and Pat and Yvonne for your presentations. Thank you very much. So 5 minutes, and we'll be back to start again. Started again. We always seem to let the breaks go a little bit longer than we say at the outset. Our next segment is case management, first portion being training, competency, and liability of social workers. And our first presenter is Eileen Lally, Chair of Department of Social Work at UAA. So if you'd like to join us, you could join us on the other side of the table if you wanted to, and we'll just, by the end of the day, we'll just have everybody up here with us because we're all together in this. Eileen, they're all friendly on that side of the table anyway, so they better be or they'll be in trouble. So please go ahead.
Squad. Now is it coming? Ah, there, we're coming through now. As Representative Ellis said, I'm the chair of the Department of Social Work here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I guess as such got tapped to come and speak to competency training and liability issues. The liability, I think I'd like to start off with first and start off with a disclaimer that I'm not a lawyer, and I think many times the liability certainly ends up in courts. But from a social worker's perspective, years ago, there wasn't any question of social worker liability, and if times and things have changed, there definitely is. We've seen an increase in malpractice suits against social workers, especially in the child welfare field. We have a burgeoning business of malpractice insurance, which people now tend to buy and carry on their own, as well as that which is covered by agencies. It's even gotten to the point where in 1985 there was a text written called the Vulnerable Social Worker Liability for Serving Children and Families. I think that's definitely an issue. Certainly, too, there's a potential liability to the state in utilizing untrained or underprepared workers to provide child welfare services, specifically in foster care. Our state, I think, has taken a great leap, and the legislature is to be congratulated. From my perspective, certainly, we now have licensing for clinical social workers. That really helps in the private sector. However, as we're all familiar, the public sector is primarily the one doing the work in foster care placement, working with the birth parents, working with natural parents. And as of this time, the state has nothing to register, certify, or license people other than those in private sectors. So I think while we've taken a great step in the liability issue, and hopefully some of that can still be worked on, the competencies are complex, and probably in about 5 hours I could maybe get through a nice list of those. Some of them are basic ones that people working in human service fields and working as social workers must have. They're critical. You need to know how to talk with people, how to interview people, how to make some assessments. But in the child welfare field, you also have to be trained in areas of what are indicators of child abuse and neglect, what are some effective intervention strategies that can be used. Specifically in terms of foster care, you have to make a judgment call. When is it critical for that youngster to be removed from home? And along with the judgment call on that end, there's the other judgment call that the minute when you take a child out of home, you also have to be very skilled in permanency planning. Permanency planning doesn't begin when you think about where is this youngster going to go. Permanency planning should begin before the child is placed, which requires a whole other set of skills in working with families, agency resources, what kinds of help is the family going to need to be able to reunify, and if that's not going to occur, then what kinds of intervention is going to be needed to work with the youngster, the birth family, in terms of permanency placement for the child. One also has to have great case management skills, so you need someone with time management, organizational skills, because one foster placement is not one person. You're not talking just the youngster. You're dealing with three separate systems, the youngster, the foster family, and the birth family. So case management is critical in assuring that services are made available to all of those systems. In Alaska, we also have, I believe, a pressing need to address and be able to have workers who understand cross-cultural issues. We have a very large Alaska Native population, and we have a growing other ethnic minority groups that people must become sensitive to and be aware of. And those are some competencies that we need, that cross-cultural training issue spoken to in terms of folks who are then going to be working in foster care placement, child protective services in general. That, very briefly, is what I would see as some of the highlights of competencies necessary. How do you get those? Which I guess is the training segment. The first thing is you need to be able in training to have someone who has a broad professional base, I believe. And again, I'm probably prejudiced because I am a social worker and teach in the social work department. But social workers have professional training that speaks to ethics and values, which determine everything else that a social worker should be doing in practice. When you have that broad-based professional training, then I think you get that supplemented by some specialties. In our baccalaureate program here in Anchorage, we have a two-semester sequence of child protective services and child placement, so that not everyone who comes out with a bachelor's in social work from our program would necessarily have that, but certainly many of our students have elected to take that two-semester sequence. And then also we've had people coming back to take the classes who may already be working in the field. And this gets very specific in terms of child welfare, effective prevention strategies, as well as getting into some of the research that says some of those very things you were talking about earlier, Representative Ellis, in terms of how do we know this is effective? We've given you these positions. What have you done with them? Prove to us. And there is certainly a whole body of research out there that indicates what can be effective child welfare practice and what really is needed in terms of, hopefully, first of all, prevention of the need of foster care placements, but many times that absolutely cannot be. And so if we're going to have foster care placements, we need to know what we're looking for and what we're doing. Training needs to cover legal aspects very definitely, because that worker is going to become very involved with the legal system. And not just from the vulnerability, but also from the aspect of providing the best service to all three parties again. Because in my belief, all three parties, the child, the birth parents, and the foster parents, have rights and responsibilities. And many times it's that social worker who is going to have to explain those and to prepare those parties to participate in the judicial process. So I see the legal part as very, very important. Again, cross-cultural and rural issues. I think we need specific training for that. In all professional programs of social work, whether at the baccalaureate or at the master's level, the accrediting body, Council on Social Work Education, has mandated that through every course they want to see proof that all people who are teaching those courses are weaving in elements of cross-cultural competency and awareness. So I think when you look in the terms of social work education, social work training, that you can see where that has occurred over their professional training period. I think truly the effectiveness of the worker depends on the training. Now, obviously, not all of the training is going to take place at the baccalaureate or the master's level. I think there's also a very specific need for OJT to have some on-the-job training and services by the agencies, because, again, the worker needs to be very familiar with the agency's policies and procedures, as well as each individual area's particular legal quirks and legal processes are very different in rural Alaska as opposed to urban Alaska in some instances, and the worker needs to be trained for that. Lack of training and lack of professional education leads to inappropriate placements, leads to failed placements, and leads to foster care drift, leads to issues that I don't know whether you discussed or saw in one of the commercial television stations, crisis in foster care. It's not just Alaska that's facing these problems. It's nationwide. And many of us in the profession have been saying, you know, training is certainly one way of addressing that. Right now we have in Anchorage and in Fairbanks baccalaureate-level training for social workers. We have a BSW program. We do not at this time have a master's-level training program in the state of Alaska. So as I speak, we are in the midst of a feasibility study to see if that is a possibility or not. So we're not training our own master's-level workers yet. I am hopeful that we shall be doing so. Briefly, that's sort of what I see, and not terribly specific. I'm not sure if it's very helpful, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that people might have.
Let's check with Representative Kopanen and the members in Juneau to see if there are any questions or comments. If not, I'd like to ask Lale to, if you'd characterize, you know, the typical interpersonal play or relationship between, in the typical connection between foster parents or a foster parent and a social worker. What kind of things are at play there that can either make it a very positive kind of where both people feel like they're important partners in a treatment team and looking out for the best interest of a child, or the kinds of things we talked before about the confidentiality and common practice being different from what the law says and the exposure there, and what other things or barriers might be in the way to a positive working relationship between person providing foster care and the caseworker?
I think some of the barriers that are there, and they may be very natural, and there hopefully are ways to overcome those, but some of those barriers are that both the social worker placing the child and the foster family feel very strongly that they are advocates for the child. Many times the foster parent, I believe, and I can't speak for foster parents, but I've heard this from foster parents having worked with them, that they're the only one speaking for the child, and that they see the social worker and agency as more advocates for the birth family and not really caring and worrying that much about the child. And the foster family has a great deal invested in that youngster in terms of you know, their emotional involvement, their caring for the child. And I think that makes life very difficult then for the two to be able to communicate and to trust one another and work, as you said, in a partnership, because they are, in effect, a partnership. Some ways of overcoming that, perhaps, is this worker is going to have to be very skilled in convincing the foster family that they, too, are very concerned about the child and that they also are seen as an advocate of the child and not as an arm of the court or an arm of the agency or not as just taking kids back and placing them back, but that they have. And I think some of the skills and competencies I touched on earlier can help that, because the worker can say, look, these are areas that we know show that the natural family is ready to have the child back. They have indeed done these kinds of things. They've worked very hard. I think also the worker can, where not legally constrained not to, can help bridge communications between the birth family and the foster family and start to build some trust and confidence there so that they're not seen as adversarial.
Are you aware of any better structures that have been devised? Because it seems like we set up here in the system that we have a set of emotions where the foster parent's advocating, you know, the greater the depth of emotion or the bonding with the child, the more likely they are, depending on their personality, to really fight what they see as the big bureaucracy that's not providing adequate resources for the child, that's not communicating well enough, not giving all the information. That's their perception in many of these cases. And it seems like so much of this comes down to personalities and which social worker can emote the best or have the best line or have the skills to calm down that foster parent, where a less experienced social worker or someone who doesn't click personally with the foster parent, and you can't click with you know, it's just not going to work in a lot of situations on a personal level, that you know, they get off on a bad start and it just builds from there and causes a great headache for the division, great emotional turmoil for the foster family. I don't know, is there a better structure where everybody feels like they're in it together and they're on the same side as opposed to competing interests?
Well, I think you hit it on the head when you said perhaps that one individual worker isn't well-trained in being able to communicate. And that's where it goes back again to competencies and training necessary for any person who's going to be a foster care worker. If in their professional training or their on-the-job training, they have learned to listen to people, which one hopes they're not graduating, at least from my program, without having learned some of those intercommunication skills and listening skills. I think, again, and I worked as a foster parent trainer prior to working at the university. The things that I heard from foster parents at that time, it wasn't so much that people don't do what we tell them to do, but people don't listen to us.